nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
Just to remind you where we were, as you know, basic thing we want is this density of states. Where do you get density of states? Starting point is Schrodinger equation. Schrodinger equation involves this potential, which is the nuclear potential, and a potential due to the other electrons, because electron-electron interaction is an important part. And in general, if you are starting from here, you'd actually have to do this problem self-consistently. And there are first principles methods which do just that, whereas what is more widely used and what we'll be doing most of this course actually is what you might call the semi-empirical approach. And the way that goes is that in general, of course, you could express the function in terms of these basis functions that we talked about, that a particular set of functions that you think are particularly suited to the problem at hand. And last day we discussed how you normally choose these functions. These would be often the atomic functions for if the atoms were all separate. So that's what you're using. And then this function that you want is expressed in terms of those functions. And all the information is really contained in these coefficients, which are numbers, because the basis functions are known. If you know the coefficients, you can construct what you want. That's the information. And these functions then, the way you find these numbers, you find by solving this matrix equation. So effectively, the differential equation has become a matrix equation. Now, people who do first principles calculations, they also would often use a basis function of some kind. All practical ways of solving the Schrodinger equation, I mean the numerical methods, would use some scheme for turning this into a matrix equation. But in first principles methods, you'd calculate these matrices, the elements of those matrices, from first principles by doing integrals like this. And then you have to do it self-consistently because you have to include the right potential and so on. Whereas in the semi-empirical approaches, what you do is you say that based on a lot of work that has gone into this material in the past, both theoretical and experimental, people believe that this matrix should look something like this. These should be the elements of the matrix. And you take those elements and then go on with it. And then use it to calculate other things. Okay? So for example, with the example we went through was this hydrogen molecule. So you have a hydrogen atom, and they form this molecule. And if you were to start from first principles, again, you choose some basis functions, try to construct this matrix. Whereas, and one set of basis functions you could use would be these 1s functions, one on each hydrogen atom. Now, in a semi-empirical approach then, what we could say is, well, I know that the matrix would look like a 2x2 matrix. And because of the symmetry, I know that whatever's on the diagonal should be the same, this and that. And whatever's out here should be the same, this T. That's because the Hamiltonians are always Hermitian. Whatever's here, you get the same thing there. And I've not bothered to write T star because in these problems, usually this is all real numbers. In general, this is the complex conjugate of that. Okay. But you'd say, well, I got two parameters, epsilon and T. So I'll look at the available experimental data on hydrogen molecules and accordingly choose epsilon and T. And then I can go on with trying to find the current voltage characteristics of a hydrogen molecule, let's say. But the only input I'd take from all the existing in literature, all the experiments and theory is those two numbers. And we can go on from there. You see? That way you're bypassing, you know, what could be easily months of work. You see? If you have those numbers. So that's the approach you adopt in this semi-empirical method. So let's take these numbers and go on from there. Now, what we did last lecture or the lecture before that, I believe, is I showed you that if you had actually gone about it in a first principles way, what kind of integrals you would have to do and what these matrices would have looked like. And in general, you'd have this H matrix and you also have a S matrix, the S matrix being these integrals. And usually, of course, you had to have both of them. And so what you'd have to then find is the solution to this equation. Now, when people use a semi-empirical method, often what they say is, let's just drop the S. Drop the S meaning assume that it's really I. I meaning the identity matrix, 1, 1, 0, 0. And solve the equation E phi equals H phi. Now, you might say, well, but that's not quite right. How can you drop this? Well, thing is that since you're adjusting the coefficients anyway, you say, well, I'll adjust these coefficients so I get it right. In the sense that if you had kept this, you could have written E phi equals some other H prime times phi, for example. So a different matrix you could have got. But then since I'm adjusting the matrix anyway, I could adjust these numbers. So someone who actually had an S and H might have got epsilon prime, T prime, epsilon prime, let's say. Instead, what we will use is, say this, where these numbers have been adjusted to take care of the S. That's the attitude. So, see? So from here on then, whenever we are talking about any material starting, we'll essentially be asking for the solutions of E phi equals H phi, where the elements of the H matrix come from some other input. Namely, based on that material, what people believe these numbers should be. That's where you're getting that input from. Okay? So if we were doing a hydrogen molecule, we would have talked about this matrix, epsilon and T. Two numbers. Based on that, we'd ask, what are the eigenvalues, what are the eigenvectors, and so on. So for example, for a hydrogen molecule, you could say, let's say the H matrix looks like this. So what are the eigenvalues of that matrix? Minus T. That's one thing I said you should remember. This is a 2x2 matrix you often encounter. A slightly more general version of this I asked you to work out in the homework problem, this latest homework problem. Put a slightly more general version of this, which is worth remembering because that way, whenever you see a 2x2, it's kind of a special case of that. See? Okay. Now, you can easily check, of course, that if you multiply by 1, 1, you'll get epsilon plus T times 1, 1. And if you multiply with 1 minus 1, you'll get epsilon minus T 1 minus 1. So what that tells you is this and this are the two eigenvectors of this matrix, and the eigenvalues are epsilon plus T and epsilon minus T. That's it. Okay. So for a hydrogen molecule then, without doing very much, you already know what the functions, the eigenfunctions should look like. In the sense, it should look like, see, 1, 1 means how do I reconstruct the actual function? Well, it is phi m times my basis functions. So it's like 1, 1 means it's 1 times this function plus 1 times that function. So if I actually plot it out, it would look something like this. Similarly, what would 1 minus 1 look like? Well, it's 1 times this function minus 1 times that function. And so if I plot it out, it would actually look something like this. So you see the simplicity of all this in the sense that here's a problem that's fairly complicated. We're trying to find the energy levels and eigenfunctions of a hydrogen molecule. But we are making use of things we know about hydrogen atoms and saying, well, then if I use that as a basis, H matrix should look something like this. And if it's like this, then the basis functions should be these. And once I have 1, 1, and 1, minus 1, I can construct the functions. And I already have an answer, and which actually looks pretty good. I mean, people who do the thing exactly. I mean, this is a problem you could do exactly. It's not too far from the real thing. So it does give you a lot of insight. And then if you adjust your epsilons and t's correctly, you could even match all the energy levels and everything fairly well. That's the thing. By the way, which one will have a lower energy? In other words, you know, that's kind of important because I mentioned earlier that the way the covalent bonding works is that you get one level that's lower and one level that's higher. And when you bring this hydrogen molecule together, both electrons go into the lower level. And that's what you call the bonding level. And the other one is the antibonding level. Now, my question is, do you see which one will be lower? Now, if you just look at this, you'd say that one has an energy of epsilon plus t. This one has an energy of epsilon minus t. So this should be lower. Offhand, if you look at it, that's what you'd think. And after all, this is, you're subtracting something. It's just that t is usually a negative number in all of this, which is why it's this one that actually has the lower energy. Bonding levels look like that usually. Between 2s orbitals would look like that, not like that. Okay, now the problem then we want to go on to is, okay, let's say we have matrices like this, but then when I have a complicated solid which has got n atoms in it, it's a huge matrix because usually I'd have at least one basis function like this per atom. And then if I have n atoms, that's a n by n matrix. So how do I write down the eigenvalues? This was 2 by 2, that's easy. That was, and that, as I said, is analytical, you should remember almost. Now, and the interesting thing is that if your solid happens to be periodic, if all the atoms are arranged in a periodic pattern, then the resulting matrices, you can actually write down their eigenvalues almost analytically. In some cases, fully analytically. In some cases, you might need a little numerical calculation. That's it. So I'd like to explain in the next few lectures exactly. I'll try to convey to you exactly this framework. This is what is called the principle of band structure. That's what I want to explain. Okay? So today we'll start with like the simplest example of this. And that is, consider a 1D solid, a 1D array of just hydrogen atoms. So like two hydrogen atoms, that's a real thing, you know, that's hydrogen molecule. But let's say you had an array, an infinite array of hydrogen atoms just arranged in a line. Question is, what would its energy eigenvalues and eigenfunctions look like? Okay. So the problem we're thinking about is like one where you got a whole bunch of hydrogen atoms going on like this forever. Let's say, you know, start somewhere at point 1, end somewhere out there at point n, and a whole bunch of points in between. And this n is a very large number. Now, of course, the way we go about it is, first thing is, we adopt basis functions, one at each atom. So I'll have n basis functions, which means that this Hamiltonian matrix, H, will look something like this. So a whole bunch of them. It's an n by n matrix. So how many parameters do I have? Well, I need something on the diagonal. Let's call that epsilon. So I'll put epsilons on the diagonal. And then I would have something, let's say, on the upper diagonal and the lower diagonal. So the upper diagonal, now what I claim is that because of the symmetry of this, this, they should all be basically the same number. Why is that? Well, because if I had actually gone about it honestly and done an integral like this, when I'm doing this integral, because, you know, things don't really change from one point to another, if I take like u2, you know, if I take this function 2 and 3, this is say 0.2, 0.3, and calculate the h23, which means like this element, because that's like 3, 2, 1, 1, 2, 3. So I'm looking at the 2, 3 element, let's say. Then when I'm doing the 2, 3 element, I try to do this integral with a u2 here and a u3 there. If I'm trying to do the 3, 4 element, I put a 3 there and a 4 there. But the thing is, the basic integral is much the same. It's just shifted over a little bit. That's all. Because it's all uniform everywhere. And at this time, of course, I'm not worrying about the edges at all. That's the point we'll come to in a minute. As long as you are nowhere near the edges, whether you're here or whether you're here, however you do the integral, it's all the same. So all these are the same number, whatever it is, because it's a periodic solid, of course. Of course, if this was amorphous, like these two things were a little closer together, that one's a little further away, then that wouldn't work. Then you'd have all kinds of, each number could be different. But if it's a nice periodic solid, then it's just T, 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 etc. And as you know, these things are usually Hermitian. Whatever you get here, you get the complex conjugate there. These are real numbers, so I just write T's. Now, what about the next one? Turn one over. Well, those in principle could be another number. I mean, another number in the sense that, supposing I'm trying to find this one. That's like the 2, 4, which means I take the wave function on 2, the wave function on 4, and then put this h operator in between. You know, this is u2, h up, u4. And that's how I actually have to be doing the integral here. If I want to find that, it's like I move this over, u3, h up, and then u5. That's what I have. And those would all again be the same number. So in principle, you might have a t prime, t prime, t prime, etc. And again, same thing here, of course. Now, the principle that I'll be describing to you, this principle of band structure, that makes use of the fact that all these are the same. So no matter where I go along this line, every row looks much the same. T prime, T, epsilon, T, T prime. T prime, T, epsilon, T, T prime, etc. Every line looks the same. That's the principle we'll be using. Now, for this discussion, we'll be ignoring anything beyond this first diagonal, beyond that. What that means is, I mean, in general, of course, you should be keeping those. It's just that from that integral, you can kind of see that these should be a whole lot less than that. Why? Well, you see, when I'm trying to find t prime, I have to do an integral like this, a 2 that's here, which dies out exponentially, and something like this, which dies out exponentially. That's the basis function here and the basis function there. When I'm finding 2, 3, I'm doing this integral, 2, h up, and then something right here. So I'm multiplying two functions which are separated by one lattice point. That's what I'm doing when I'm trying to find 2, 3. h23. And when I'm trying to find h24, that's when it's like two functions that are separated by two lattice points. And because of that, when I multiply this and this, the result is a whole lot less. You see, because wherever this is sizable, this one has almost died out. Whereas here, because they're kind of close together, the results are, you get bigger answers. So in general, the further you go, the smaller these elements go. You see? And again, if you're doing a first principles calculation, you'd of course keep them all. Because even if it's small, it may not be negligible. On the other hand, if you're using a semi-empirical method where you're going to adjust parameters anyway, then you say the fewer the parameters that is better. Because with lots of parameters, you can fit anything. I mean, you really want to do it with as few parameters as possible, because then that is much more convenient, and then if you can cover a wide range of experiments with few parameters, it means you're actually getting something right. See? So usually in all these semi-empirical models, people do what's called a nearest neighbor model. What that means is they only keep those elements that go from one site to the nearest neighbor, not further. So you kind of stop here usually. And so these are all assumed to be zeros. But the principle of band structure that we'll be talking about, that's not really limited to this nearest neighbor model. It would work much more generally. It would work even if you had all the other ones around. Okay. Now, one thing that's useful to do also is that here I wrote out the matrix. Now, once you go to two dimensions, it's a little more inconvenient to write out the matrix. So, for example, one thing we want to discuss is what's called graphene, because these days there's a lot of research on this material, which is actually a layer of graphite. And it's like carbon atoms that are arranged in a hexagonal pattern like this. And this we'll be talking about, like, a couple of lectures from now. But here also the model people use is that as far as the diagonal elements are concerned, let's say I've got some parameter epsilon. And then for the nearest neighbor, we have some parameter, say, t, for the nearest neighbors. So what that means is between this and this, there's a t, between this and this, there's a t, etc. So in principle, no more complicated than what we had here. You know, this 1D model we are talking about, that's also like you have an epsilon on every atom, and then there's a T that's coupling the nearest neighbors. So this model is also just like that, epsilon on every atom, and then there's a T that couples the nearest neighbors, except that to write out the matrix for this one is a lot harder than to write out the matrix for this one. You see, because here it's simple. I mean, you can visualize it this way, or you can write out the matrix. Epsilon on the diagonal, T on the upper diagonal, T on the lower diagonal. Done. Here, it's not like you're still epsilon on the diagonal, but those T's are not just on upper diagonals and lower diagonals. It's on more than that. Why? Because every site actually has three nearest neighbors. So for every line, you'll actually end up with T in three places, because that point has three things that are kind of nearest to it. So as soon as you go to structures like this or in higher dimensions, you see, writing the matrix is a whole lot harder than telling you physically that, oh yeah, I just have something on this on site and something to its nearest neighbor, you know. And often it's really not necessary to write out the matrix, because this whole principle of band structure, once you understand it, you don't actually have to write out the matrix. If you are going to ask a computer to do it, of course, a computer wouldn't understand this. I mean, you'd actually have to write out the matrix and give it to it. But this principle of band structure, once you understand it, you just need this picture to write out all the eigenvalues and eigenfunctions. Once you have this picture, you can do it. You don't really need to write the matrix. Okay? So one thing that's important to get used to is, like, here we're doing it. We're writing out this matrix. But mentally remember, this is basically that. That it's like epsilon on site, T to the nearest neighbor. Okay. And in principle, we could have had a next nearest neighbor model where you had a T prime going to the next nearest one, in which case we'd have shown a picture like that. So right now it's epsilon T, T. You could have kept a T prime, but which we won't do at this time. We'll just drop that. Okay. So the problem that I want to talk about for the rest of the class today is, how would you write down the eigenvalues of that matrix? Because as it stands, it's an n by n matrix. You have to go to a computer. Now, the way you do this is something like following. You see, the equation we are trying to solve, this, is E phi equals H phi. So what you're really trying to do is, this is the H matrix. So what you're trying to solve is the following equation. E phi, you know, which is phi 1, phi 2, down to phi n, is equal to that matrix times phi. So when you write E phi equals H phi, what you really mean is something like this. And as you know, that amounts to n separate algebraic equations. You could write E phi 1 equals epsilon phi 1 plus T phi 2, E phi 2 equals T phi 1 plus epsilon phi 2 plus T phi 3, etc. You could write a whole set of them, n of them. And one way to write it would be, say, you could write E phi n is equal to so if you go to the nth row, wherever that may be, then the E phi n is equal to epsilon times how much? Phi n itself, right? Because that's the diagonal point, it's the nn point. So it'd be like epsilon phi n. And then there's a t before it and a t after it. So the t before it would multiply n minus 1, right? Because wherever the phi n may be, the one before it is n minus 1, one after it is n plus 1. So you'd write t phi n minus 1 plus this plus t phi n plus 1. So you could, instead of writing this full matrix equation, could have just written that and said n goes from 1 to n. And that would then define for you all capital N algebraic equations. And of course, the matrix equation is equivalent to capital N algebraic equations. No question. Right? That's it. One little thing I'm glossing over, we'll come back to, and that's the what happens at the ends. Because kind of wrote this down, but if you really tried to go to do something at n equals 1, you'd end up with a phi 0, which isn't quite there, because if your solid really ends here, there isn't anything there. Right? You have that problem. Right? So that issue I'll come to in a minute, but we have discussed this once before in the context of finite difference, where I said that usually you use these two things, either the periodic boundary conditions or the box boundary conditions. In the context of band structure, though, what people always use is the periodic boundary conditions. So periodic boundary conditions means that when you see a zero, you call that n. It's as if the whole thing is in a ring. So whenever it is, so if it's epsilon t here, you put a t there. And similarly on the last line, it's epsilon t. T epsilon, and then the next T comes over here. Like as if you had this periodic boundary conditions. Now you say, well, but that's not usually the case. I mean, when we're talking about a solid, it's something like this. It's not like this end is tied here. That's very true. And so there is really no good mathematical justification for this. And the only justification people use, and this is widely used in all of solid state physics and all this studies of solids, is really a physical one. And the physical justification goes like this. You say that in any solid, I'm trying to calculate some properties that depends on its density of states somewhere in the middle of the solid, let's say. Not quite at the edges. I'm not trying to figure out what happens at surfaces. I want to know what kind of happens that's typical of the solid. And the thing is, I know physically that what the real boundary condition doesn't matter too much. In the sense, if I put my hand there, it shouldn't affect things normally. See, that's the thing. So the argument is that physically I know that the real boundary condition doesn't matter. You could do something here, it still wouldn't change what's happening inside. And since the real boundary condition doesn't matter, why spend a lot of effort trying to model the real boundary condition? We might as well take something that makes our life mathematically the simplest. And in this context, you see, if you assume this periodic boundary condition, then you have this great principle of band structure that I'll be describing to you. that allows you to write down all the eigenvalues analytically. If you didn't assume periodic boundary condition, then it wouldn't be strictly true, because the edges would make it so that what is inside is a little different from what's right near the edge. But by assuming periodic boundary conditions, what happens is the entire solid, no matter where you are, looks much the same. Even when you're near an edge, there is really no edge, because you kind of see the other side again. It's like a ring. See? So in most cases, then, this is just a matter of convenience based on that physical argument. The only real solid I know where you actually have periodic boundary condition is something called a carbon nanotube, which lately actually has been very interesting. Lots of research on that. Yeah.
I think there is a structure based on carbon which is has a shape of
Right, a C60.
Yes. Is that does it have in every direction? Is it what happened with the periodic boundary condition?
So C60 would be one case where it's actually like the surface of a sphere. They say the soccer ball, it's kind of like that. And there, although because it's a closed thing, I'm not sure if they actually use a periodic boundary condition, or whether they just solve for the whole thing directly, or whether you could use that in some clever way to get analytical results. That I don't know. I'm not sure offhand. But the carbon nanotube is one where it's just like a sheet that's folded like this, like a straw. You know, so it becomes like a cylinder. And there you use periodic boundary conditions routinely. And that's kind of related to it's both made of carbon. The C60, that's just 60 carbon atoms actually in that shape. And the carbon nanotube is a graphite sheet that's rolled over. But everything else, of course, usually there's nothing like a periodic boundary condition at all. It's really a convenient thing. And the thing to remember is when you're trying to model nanostructures, you know, real small things, then surfaces do matter. And there is really no good reason, ordinarily, to be using a periodic boundary condition. So if I were trying to model a solid, it was kind of huge in this plane. But then it was only a few nanometers this way. Then I would use periodic boundary conditions in the plane, but I wouldn't use it in this direction. In this direction, I'd do it right, use whatever real boundary conditions I have, because periodic wouldn't be right at all. Okay. Anyway, so point is then that if you assume periodic boundary conditions, then the thing is, you can write down the solutions to that equation without going to a computer. What I'll show you is, I'll just write down the answer and show you that it satisfies all the equations. You know, I've got a whole set of equations, capital N set, right? N equals 1, 2, 3, 4, etc. And what I'll do is I'll write down a solution which you'll see will satisfy all of them automatically. Okay? And the solution looks something like this. Phi N is equal to phi 0 e to the power I N. So what I'm putting down just as an ansatz is that phi n is equal to some constant times exponential I n, the same n, and then some number k a. I could have just called it, I didn't have to call it ka as it is. It could have been any other symbol here. And we'll talk about what this needs to be, etc. That we'll get to in a minute. But the point is, no matter what you put there, this will satisfy that entire set of equations for all n. That's what I want to show. Okay. And the way it works is, if I substitute this back in there, what you'd get is something like this. So I'm just taking this solution that I've proposed, put it back in there. Okay, so this is E phi 0, e to the power I n k a. Now, here I need phi n minus 1. So how do I write that? Well, phi n minus 1 is exactly like this, except that in place of n, I got n minus 1. That's all. You see? So I write T phi 0, e to the power I n minus 1 times k a. And then I have to write epsilon phi n. So epsilon phi 0 e to the power I n k a. And finally, I have to write t phi n plus 1. So can you help me with what's the exponential? E to the power I. So now I've got an n plus 1 there. So I put an n plus 1 there. See? So all I did was just took the solution, substituted in there, and see if it works. Okay. So now what I can do is, see, I can of course cancel out the phi zeros. That's the easiest thing. And let me divide by e to the power I n k a. Just divide through. So what I'll get is E is equal to T times, can you help me? Right, you see, this is e to the power I n k a and then e to the power minus I k a. And this is e to the power I n k a. So when I divide, I'm left with e to the power just minus I k a. That's that one. What about the next one? Plus epsilon. What about the any exponential factors? No. E to the power i n k cancels out. And then plus last one, when the I n k is taken out, just e to the power plus I k is left. That's it. And then you can use this rule that if I add those two, what do I get? Something like this. Because there's two exponentials. When you add, you get twice the cosine. That's it. Okay, so what that tells me is that this solution that I proposed does satisfy this equation no matter what I put here, Ka. You know, this Ka could be 30 degrees, could be 33.7 degrees, could be 41.5 degrees, anything you want. You can put anything there. This will satisfy that equation. It's just that this number that I get, you know, eigenfunction means, you know, it has a certain E that goes with that function. The number that I get, that of course will depend on exactly what I put in. If I put 41.7, I'd get one answer. If I put 43.8, I'll get something else. But anything would do, in a way, right? Anyway. So often then, you could, people would draw a picture of this. So you have an E here and a Ka. That's it. And if you plot that, what you'd get is something like this. So can you tell me what's this maximum value? When Ka is 0, you get epsilon plus 2t. And can you help me with what's the minimum value? Now, cosine Ka, the smallest it gets is minus 1. That's when Ka is equal to pi. So that's the point where Ka is minus pi or plus pi, any of them. And the smallest it gets it is epsilon minus 2t. Now, one little thing. The way I've drawn it, I've kind of assumed t to be a positive number. Because otherwise, this curve would have kind of flipped over. You see? This would have been a minimum. That would have been a maximum. And that's true. If t is negative, which is often the case, actually. T is negative, then this curve would have looked the other way. But the point I wanted to make before we go on, before like we finish up today, is that there's something that's not yet clear very well. Is this? Yes, please. No. What's not clear is the way I showed it to you. It's like you can choose any ka you want, and you'll find a solution. Now, that doesn't quite sound right because, you see, remember, I originally said that we were going to give you, that I was going to describe to you a way of writing down analytically the eigenvalues of this problem. You know, the problem with a lattice with n points. Now, if you didn't know about all this stuff and you had gone to a computer, you'd have come out with n eigenvalues. You know, let's say there's 100 points on your solid. You'd come back with 100 eigenvalues. The way I describe to you, it looks like you got an infinite number of eigenvalues. You know, you can say, well, you choose any k, you got a solution. So you got, you know, every eigenvalues. That can't be right, you see? So how exactly do I get n eigenvalues out of this? And this is where you have to bring in two things. One is this business of the periodic boundary condition. That is, that zero is the same as capital M. So what that means is that not all KAs are acceptable. It is only those that would give you phi N equals phi zero. You see? Because based on this ansatz, you'd write phi capital N is equal to phi zero e to the power I capital N times KA. And of course, if I put N equals 0, I'd just get phi 0. Okay. But the point is that because it's a periodic boundary condition, the point 0 is physically the same as the point N. And so these two things have to be the same number because at that point the function has some value. And those two need to be the same. What that means is this quantity has to be equal to 1. And that, of course, means that this has to be some multiple of 2 pi, whatever. So Ka times N must be equal to 2 pi times some integer, whatever it is, 0, 1, 2, anything. And I can drop the N from here, put an N. So what that tells me is I can't just choose any old Ka. I can only choose those that are multiples of 2 pi over N. Okay, so what that means is when I go down this line, I could choose Ka equals 0, or I could choose something that's 2 pi over N, or I could choose something that's 4 pi over N, and so on, some multiple of it. So I can't just choose anything like I was saying, 41.3 degrees, 47.8 degrees, etc. It has to be some multiple of that. Of course, the bigger the solid, the smaller this unit. So in that sense, it gets more and more continuous. But I still have an infinite number, though, if you look at this. I mean, okay, sure, they're not, I can't put them real close, but then this goes on forever. Wait, look. Now, this is where the second concept comes in, which is to say that if you take any value of Ka, whatever it is, and add 2 pi to it, this and this are essentially the same solution. So this is not a separate thing from that one. Those represent the same thing. So this is a whole different issue. And so, and I'll explain why in a minute. So those two are not separate things. So when I look at these solutions, I should only go from minus pi to plus pi. I mean, I should only look over a range of 2 pi. I could go from any point to any point, but as long as the range is 2 pi. It could be 0 to 2 pi, minus pi to pi, whatever it is. Because any point here, when I add 2 pi to it, it does not give me a new solution. It just gives me the same old solution back. Really. That's the point I'll convince you in a minute. But now you can see I will actually get n eigenvalues. Why? Because I'm looking over a range 2 pi, and the allowed values of Ka are spaced by 2 pi over n, so the number of values I'll always get is capital N. You see? That's it. And that should match exactly what I'd have got if I didn't know anything about band structure and had just put in that n by n matrix and asked the computer to do it. Those should be exactly the same, and it's easy to check with a few examples. I mean, the next homework problem will have a couple of examples to check that out, actually. Okay. So let me just finish up by pointing out why adding 2 pi doesn't really get you a new solution. So the idea is that if someone has a solution looking like this, and someone else comes along and says that, no, my solution looks like this, you know? So one person writes this solution, another person has a different k, which is 2 pi bigger. And they say, okay, my solution is that one. What I claim is that they are really, it's really the same solution. Why is that? Because as soon as you go to any particular point n and try to find, okay, let's see what your solution tells me. What's the wave function? And this guy goes and finds out what the wave function is. They'll get exactly the same number. Why? Because no matter which n you go to, his solution is basically multiplied here by e to the power I n 2 pi. You see, that solution is really the same as that, except that it's multiplied by e to the power I n 2 pi. And that for any value of n is essentially 1. You see? So when you go to this lattice and actually find what is your wave function at various points, that and that give you exactly the same answer. Now, of course, if you looked at a point that was kind of halfway between 2 points, then they would have got different answers. You see? Because then you would have been looking at, say, n would have been not 1, 2, 3 like that, but maybe let's say it's 3.5. Because you're looking at a point between two lattice points. Then, of course, those two would have represented different solutions. But then, there is nothing there. So we only are, the functions are only defined at those points. We are only talking of 1, 2, 3. There's no 3.5 in this. And so, in a discrete lattice like this, the point is that only, you only need to look over a range. And those of you who have had any courses in signal theory, you might see some connection to discrete Fourier transforms as opposed to the analog, the usual Fourier transform. But if you have not seen it, you know, don't worry about it. Yeah, let me stop here today and have a good break. I think I'm right this time. See you on Wednesday.